Although cynics always sounded more plausible than the cockeyed optimists of the world, Ralph's experience had been that they were wrong at least as much of the time, if not more. And he was delighted to find that McGovern was wrong about Helen Deepnow. In her case, a single verse of the beaten-up, broken-hearted blues seemed to have been enough. On Wednesday of the following week, just as Ralph was deciding he'd better track down the woman Helen had spoken with in the hospital, Tilbury. Her name had been Gretchen Tilbury. And tried to make sure Helen was okay, he received a letter from her. The return address was simple. Just Helen and Nat, High Ridge. But it was enough to relieve Ralph's mind considerably. He sat down in his chair on the porch, tore the end off the envelope, and shook out two sheets of lined paper crammed with Helen's back-slanted handwriting. "Dear Ralph," the letter began, "I suppose by now you must be thinking I decided to be mad at you after all. But I really didn't. It's just that we're supposed to stay out of contact with everyone, by phone and letter, for the first few days. Rules of the house. I like this place very much, and so does Nat. Of course she does. There are at least six kids her age to crawl around with. As for me, I'm finding more women who know what I've been through than I ever would have believed. I mean, you see the TV shows. Oprah talks with women who love men who use them for punching bags. But when it happens to you, you can't help feeling that it's happening in a way it's never happened to anyone else, in a way that's brand new to the world. The relief of knowing that's not true is the best thing that's happened to me in a long, long time." She talked about the chores to which she had been assigned, working in the garden, helping to repaint an equipment shed, washing the storm windows with vinegar and water, and about Nat's adventures in learning to walk. The rest of the letter was about what had happened and what she intended to do about it. And it was here that Ralph for the first time really sensed the emotional turmoil Helen must be feeling, her worries about the future, and counterbalancing these things, a formidable determination to do what was right for Nat, and for her, too. Helen seemed to be just discovering that she also had a right to the right thing. Ralph was happy she had found out, but sad when he thought of all the dark times she must have trudged through in order to reach that simple insight. "I'm going to divorce him," she wrote. "Part of my mind, it sounds like my mother when it talks, just about howls when I put it that bluntly, but I'm tired of fooling myself about my situation. There's a lot of therapy out here, the kind of thing where people sit around in a circle and use up about 4 boxes of Kleenex in the course of an hour. But it all seems to come back to seeing things plain. In my case, the plain fact is that the man I married has been replaced by a dangerous paranoid. That he can sometimes be loving and sweet isn't the point, but a distraction. I need to remember that the man who used to bring me hand-picked flowers now sometimes sits on the porch and talks to someone who isn't there. A man he calls the little bald doctor. Isn't that a beaut? I think I have an idea of how all this started, Ralph. And when I see you, I'll tell you, if you really want to hear. I should be back at the house on Harris Avenue, for a while anyway, by mid-September, if only to look for a job. But no more about that now. The whole subject scares me to death. I had a note from Ed, just a paragraph, but a great relief just the same, saying that he was staying at one of the cottages at the Hawking Labs compound in Fresh Harbor, and that he would honor the non-contact clause in the bail agreement. He said he was sorry for everything, but I didn't get any real sense of it, if he was. It's not that I was expecting tear stains on the letter, or a package with his ear in it, but I don't know. It was as if he wasn't really apologizing at all, but just getting on the record. Does that make sense? He also included a $750 check, which seems to indicate he understands his responsibilities. That's good, but I think I'd have been happier to hear he was getting help with his mental problems. That should be his sentence, you know. 18 months at hard therapy. I said that in group, and several people laughed as if they thought I was joking. I wasn't. Sometimes I get these scary pictures in my head when I try to think of the future. I see us standing in line at Manor for a free meal, or me walking into the Third Street homeless shelter with Nat in my arms, wrapped in a blanket. When I think of that stuff, I start to shake. Sometimes I cry. I know it's stupid. I've got a graduate degree in library science, for God's sake, but I can't help it. And do you know what I hold on to when those bad pictures come? What you said after you took me behind the counter in the Red Apple and sat me down. You told me that I had a lot of friends in the neighborhood, and I was going to get through this. I know I have one friend, at least. One very true friend. The letter was signed, Love, Helen. Ralph wiped tears from the corners of his eyes. He cried at the drop of a hat just lately, it seemed. It probably came from being so goddamn tired. And read the P.S. she had crammed in at the bottom of the sheet and up the right-hand margin. I'd love to have you come and visit, but men are off limits out here for reasons I'm sure you will understand. They even want us to be quiet about the exact location. H. Ralph sat for a minute or two with Helen's letter in his lap, looking out over Harris Avenue. It was the tag end of August now, still summer, but the leaves of the poplars had begun to gleam silver when the wind stroked them, and there was the first touch of coolness in the air. The sign in the window of the Red Apple said, School supplies of all types. Check here first. And somewhere out by the Newport town line, in some big old farmhouse where battered women went to try and start putting their lives back together, Helen Deepnow was washing storm windows, getting them ready for another long winter. He slid the letter carefully back into its envelope, trying to remember how long Ed and Helen had been married. 7 or 8 years, he thought. Carolyn would have known for sure. How much courage does it take to fire up your tractor and plow under a crop you spent 7 or 8 years growing, he asked himself. How much courage to go on and do that after you've spent all that time finding out how to prepare the soil and when to plant and how much to water and when to reap. How much to just say, I have to quit these peas. Peas are no good for me. I better try corn or beans. A lot, he said, wiping at the corners of his eyes again. A damn lot, that's what I think. Suddenly he wanted very badly to see Helen again, to repeat what she so well remembered hearing and what he could barely remember saying. You'll be okay. You'll get through this. You have a lot of friends in the neighborhood. Take it to the bank, Ralph said. Hearing from Helen seemed to have taken a great weight off his shoulders. He got up, put her letter in his back pocket, and started up Harris Avenue toward the picnic area on the extension. If he was lucky, he could find Faye Chapin or Don Veazey and play a little chess. His relief at hearing from Helen did nothing to alleviate Ralph's insomnia. The premature waking continued, and by Labor Day he was opening his eyes around 2:45 a.m. By the 10th of September, the day when Ed Deepnow was arrested again, this time along with 15 others, Ralph's average night's sleep had shrunk to roughly 3 hours, and he'd begun to feel quite a little bit like something on a slide under a microscope. Just a lonely protozoa, that's me, he thought, as he sat in the wing-back chair, staring out at Harris Avenue, and wished he could laugh. His list of surefire, never-miss folk remedies continued to grow, and it had occurred to him more than once that he could write an amusing little book on the subject, if, that was, he ever got enough sleep to make organized thinking possible again. This late summer he was doing well to slide into matching socks each day, and his mind kept turning to his purgatorial efforts to find a cup of soup in the kitchen cabinet on the day Helen had been beaten. There'd been no return to that level since, because he had managed at least some sleep every night. But Ralph was terribly afraid he would arrive there again, and perhaps places beyond there, if things didn't improve. There were times, usually sitting in the wing-back chair at 4:30 in the morning, when he swore he could actually feel his brains draining. The remedies ranged from the sublime to the ridiculous. The best example of the former was a full-color brochure advertising the wonders of the Minnesota Institute for Sleep Studies in St. Paul. A fair example of the latter was the Magic Eye, an all-purpose amulet sold through supermarket tabloids like the National Enquirer and Inside View. Sue, the counter girl at the Red Apple, bought one of these and presented it to him one afternoon. Ralph looked down at the badly painted blue eye staring up at him from the medallion, which he believed had probably started life as a poker chip, and felt wild laughter bubbling up inside him. He somehow managed to suppress it until he had regained the safety of his own upstairs apartment across the street, and for that he was very grateful. The gravity with which Sue had given it to him, and the expensive-looking gold chain she had threaded through the eyelet on top, suggested it had cost her a fair amount of money. She had regarded Ralph with something close to awe since the day the two of them had rescued Helen. This made Ralph uncomfortable, but he had no idea what to do about it. In the meantime, he supposed it didn't hurt to wear the medallion, so she could see the shape of it under his shirt. It didn't help him sleep, though. After taking his statement on Ralph's part in the deep-nosed domestic problems, Detective John Lydecker had pushed back his desk chair, laced his fingers together behind his not inconsiderable breadth of neck, and said that McGovern had told him Ralph suffered from insomnia. Ralph allowed that he did. Lydecker nodded, rolled his chair forward again, clasped his hands atop the litter of paperwork beneath which the surface of his desk was mostly buried, and looked at Ralph seriously. "Honeycomb," he said. His tone of voice reminded Ralph of McGovern's tone when he had suggested that whiskey was the answer, and his reply now was exactly the same. "I beg your pardon?" "My grandfather swore by it," Lydecker said. "Little piece of honeycomb just before bedtime. Suck the honey out of the comb, chew the wax a little, like you would a wad of gum, then spit it in the trash. Bees secrete some sort of natural sedative when they make honey. Put you right out." "No kidding," Ralph said, simultaneously believing it was utter crap and believing every word. "Where would a person get honeycomb, do you think?"
"Nutra, the health food store out at the mall. Try it. By next week this time, your troubles are going to be over."
Ralph enjoyed the experiment. The comb honey was so sweetly powerful, it seemed to suffuse his whole being. But he still awoke at 3:10 a.m. after the first dosage, at 3:08 after the second, and at 3:07 after the third. By then the small piece of honeycomb he'd purchased was gone, and he went out to Nutra right away for another one. Its value as a sedative might be nil, but it made a wonderful snack. He only wished he had discovered it earlier. He tried putting his feet in warm water. Lois bought him something called an all-purpose gel wrap from a catalog. You put it around your neck, and it was supposed to take care of your arthritis as well as help you sleep. It did neither for Ralph, but he had only the mildest case of arthritis to begin with. Following a chance meeting with Trigger Vachon at the counter of Nicky's lunch, he tried chamomile tea.
"That chamomile's a beaut," Trig told him. "You're going to sleep great, Ralphie."
And Ralphie did. Right up until 2:58 a.m., that was. Those were the folk cures and homeopathic remedies he tried. Ones he didn't included megavitamin packages, which cost much more than Ralph could afford to spend on his fixed income. A yoga position called the dreamer, as described by the postman, the dreamer sounded to Ralph like a fine way to get a look at your own hemorrhoids. And marijuana. Ralph considered this last one very carefully before deciding it would very likely turn out to be an illegal version of the whiskey and the honeycomb and the chamomile tea. Besides, if McGovern found out Ralph was smoking pot, he would never hear the end of it. And through all these experiments, a voice in his brain kept asking him if he really was going to have to get down to Eye of Newt and Tongue of Toad before he gave up and went to the doctor. That voice was not so much critical as genuinely curious. Ralph had become fairly curious himself. On September 10th, the day of the first Friends of Life demonstration at Woman Care, Ralph decided that he would try something from the drugstore. But not the Rexall downtown, where he'd gotten Carol's prescriptions filled. They knew him down there, knew him well, and he didn't want Paul Durgan, the Rexall druggist, to see him buying sleeping pills. It was probably stupid, like going across town to buy rubbers, but that didn't change the way he felt. He had never traded at the Rite Aid across from Strawford Park, so that was where he meant to go.
And if the drugstore version of Newt's Eye and Toad's Tongue didn't work, he really would go to the doctor. Is that true, Ralph? Do you really mean it?
I do,
he said out loud as he walked slowly down Harris Avenue in the bright September sunshine. Be damned if I'll put up with this much longer.
Big talk, Ralph, the voice replied skeptically.
Bill McGovern and Lois Chass were standing outside the park, having what looked like an animated discussion. Bill looked up, saw him, and motioned for him to come over. Ralph went, not liking the combination of their expressions. Bright-eyed interest on McGovern's face, distress and worry on Lois's. Have you heard about the thing out at the hospital? She asked as Ralph joined them.
It wasn't at the hospital, and it wasn't a thing, McGovern said testily. It was a demonstration, that's what they called it anyway, and it was at Woman Care, which is actually behind the hospital. They took a bunch of people to jail, somewhere between 6 and 24. Nobody really seems to know yet.
One of them was Ed Deepnow, Lois said breathlessly, and McGovern shot her a disgusted glance. He clearly believed that handling this piece of news had been his job.
Ed? Ralph said, startled. Ed's in Fresh Harbor.
Wrong, McGovern said. The battered-down fedora he was wearing today gave him a slightly rakish look, like a newspaper man in a 40s crime drama. Ralph wondered if the Panama was still lost or had merely been retired for the fall. Today he's once more cooling his heels in our picturesque city jail.
What exactly happened?
But neither of them really knew. At that point, the story was little more than a rumor which had spread through the park like a contagious head cold. A rumor which was of particular interest in this part of town because Ed Deepnow's name was attached to it. Marie Callan had told Lois that there had been rock throwing involved, and that was why the demonstrators had been arrested. According to Stan Eberle, who had passed the story on to McGovern shortly before McGovern ran into Lois, someone, it might have been Ed, but it might well have been one of the others, had maced a couple of doctors as they used the walkway between Woman Care and the back entrance to the hospital. This walkway was technically public property and had become a favorite haunt of anti-abortion demonstrators during the 7 years that Woman Care had been providing abortions on demand. The two versions of the story were so vague and conflicting that Ralph felt he could reasonably hope neither was true. That perhaps it was just a case of a few over-enthusiastic people who had been arrested for trespassing or something. In places like Derry, that kind of thing happened. Stories had a way of inflating like beach balls as they were passed from mouth to mouth. Yet he couldn't shake the feeling that this time it would turn out to be more serious, mostly because both the Bill version and the Lois version included Ed Deepnow, and Ed was not your average anti-abortion protester. This was, after all, the guy who had pulled a clump of his wife's hair right out of her scalp, rearranged her dental work, and fractured her cheekbone simply because he had seen her name on a petition which mentioned Woman Care. This was the guy who seemed honestly convinced that someone calling himself the Crimson King, it would be a great name for a pro wrestler, Ralph thought, was running around Derry, and that his minions were hauling their unborn victims out of town on flatbed trucks, plus a few pickups with the fetuses stuffed into barrels marked fertilizer. No, he had an idea that if Ed had been there, it had probably not been just a case of someone accidentally bonked on the head with a protest sign.
Let's go up to my house, Lois proposed suddenly. I'll call Simone Castengay. Her niece is the day receptionist at Woman Care. If anyone knows exactly what happened up there this morning, it'll be Simone. She'll have called Barbara.
I was just on my way down to the supermarket, Ralph said. It was a lie, of course, but surely a very small one. The market stood next to the Rite Aid in the strip mall, half a block down from the park. Why don't I stop in on my way back?
All right, Lois said, smiling at him. We'll expect you in a few minutes, won't we, Bill?
Yes, McGovern said, and suddenly swept her into his arms. It was a bit of a reach, but he managed. In the meantime, I'll have you all to myself. Oh, Lois, how these sweet minutes will fly. Just inside the park, a group of young women with babies in strollers, a gossip of mothers, Ralph thought, had been watching them, probably attracted by Lois's gestures, which had a tendency to become grandiose when she was excited. Now, as McGovern bent low as backward, looking down at her with a counterfeit ardor of a bad actor at the end of a stage tango, one of the mothers spoke to another, and both laughed. It was a shrill, unkind sound that made Ralph think of chalk squealing on blackboards and forks dragged across porcelain sinks. "Look at the funny old people," the laughter said. "Look at the funny old people pretending to be young again." Ralph looked at them hard, trying to send them a thought. "You'll get here. Maybe you don't believe that now, but you will." "Stop that, Bill," Lois said. She was blushing, and maybe not just because Bill was up to his usual tricks. She'd also heard the laughter from the park. McGovern undoubtedly had, too. But McGovern would believe they were laughing with him, not at him. Sometimes, Ralph thought wearily, a slightly inflated ego could be a protection. McGovern let her go, then removed his fedora and swept it across his waist as he made an exaggerated bow. Lois was too busy making sure that her silk blouse was still tucked into the waistband of her skirt all the way around to pay him much notice. Her blush was already fading, and Ralph saw she looked tired and not particularly well. He hoped she wasn't coming down with something. "Come by if you can," she told Ralph quietly. "I will, Lois." McGovern slipped an arm around her waist, the gesture of affection both friendly and sincere this time, and they started up the street together. Watching them, Ralph was suddenly gripped by a strong sense of déjà vu, as if he had seen them like that in some other place, or some other life. Then, just as McGovern dropped his arm, breaking the illusion, it came to him. Fred Astaire leading a dark-haired and rather plump Ginger Rogers out onto a small-town movie set, where they would dance together to some tune by Jerome Kern, or maybe Lerner Lowe. "That's weird," he thought, turning back toward the little strip mall halfway down up Mile Hill. "That's very weird, Ralph. Bill McGovern and Lois Chass are about as far from Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers as you can..." "Ralph?" Lois called, and he turned back. There was one intersection, and about a block's worth of distance between them now. Cars zipped back and forth on Elizabeth Street, turning Ralph's view of them into a moderate stutter. "What?" he called back. "You look better, more rested. Are you finally getting some sleep?" "Yes," he returned, thinking just another small lie and another good cause. "Didn't I say you'd feel better once the seasons changed? See you in a little while." Lois wiggled her fingers at him, and Ralph was amazed to see bright blue diagonal lines stream back from the short but carefully shaped nails. They looked like contrails. "What the fuck?" He shut his eyes tight, then popped them open again. Nothing. Only Bill and Lois once again walking up the street toward Lois's house, their backs to him. No bright blue diagonals in the air. Nothing like that. Ralph's eyes dropped to the sidewalk, and he saw that Lois and Bill were leaving tracks behind them on the concrete. Tracks that looked exactly like the footprints in the old Arthur Murray Learn to Dance instructions you used to be able to get by mail order. Lois's were gray, McGovern's, larger but still oddly delicate, were a dark shade of olive green. They glowed on the sidewalk, and Ralph, who was standing on the far side of Elizabeth Street with his jaw hanging almost down to his breastbone, suddenly realized he could see little ribbons of colored smoke rising from them. Or perhaps it was steam. A city bus bound for Old Cape snored by, momentarily blocking his view up the street, and when it passed, the tracks were gone. There was nothing on the sidewalk but a message chalked inside a fading pink heart. "Sam and Deanie, forever." "Those tracks are not gone, Ralph. They were never there in the first place. You know that, don't you?" Yes, he knew. The idea that Bill and Lois looked like Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers had gotten into his head, progressing from that idea to a hallucination of phantom footprints leading up the sidewalk like tracks in an Arthur Murray dance diagram, had a certain bizarre logic. Still, it was scary. His heart was beating too fast. And when he closed his eyes for a moment to try and calm down, he saw those marks trailing up from Lois's waving fingers like bright blue jet contrails. I've got to get more sleep, Ralph thought. I've got to. If I don't, I'm apt to start seeing anything.
That's right, he muttered under his breath as he turned toward the drugstore again. Anything at all. Ten minutes later, Ralph was standing at the front of the Rite Aid drugstore and looking at a sign which hung on chains from the ceiling. Feel better at Rite Aid, it said, seeming to suggest that feeling better was a goal attainable by any reasonable, hard-working consumer. Ralph had his doubts. This, Ralph decided, was retail drug dealing on a grand scale. It made the Rexall, where he usually traded, look like a tenement apartment by comparison. The bright, fluorescent-lit aisles seemed as long as bowling alleys and displayed everything from toaster ovens to jigsaw puzzles. After a little study, Ralph decided aisle 3 contained most of the patent medicines and was probably his best bet. He made his way slowly through the area marked stomach remedies, sojourned briefly in the kingdom of analgesics, and quickly crossed the land of laxatives. And there, between laxatives and decongestants, he stopped. This is it, folks, my last shot. After this, there's only Dr. Litchfield, and if he suggests chewing honeycomb or drinking chamomile tea, I'll probably snap, and it'll take both nurses and the receptionist to pull me off him. Sleeping aids, the sign over this section of aisle 3 read. Ralph, never much of a patent medicine user, he would otherwise have arrived here much sooner, no doubt, didn't know exactly what he'd expected, but it surely had not been this wild, almost indecent profusion of products. His eyes slipped across the boxes. The majority were a soothing blue. Reading the names, most seemed strange and slightly ominous. Compose, Nitol, Sleepinol, Z-Power, Somanex, Sleepinex, Drowsy. There was even a generic brand. You have to be kidding, he thought. None of these things are going to work for you. It's time to quit fucking around, don't you know that? When you start to see colored footprints on the sidewalk, it's time to quit fucking around and go to the doctor. But on the heels of this, he heard Dr. Litchfield. Heard him so clearly, it was as if a tape recorder had turned on in the middle of his head. Your wife is suffering from tension headaches, Ralph. Unpleasant and painful, but not life-threatening. I think we can take care of the problem. Unpleasant and painful, but not life-threatening. Yes, right. That was what the man had said. And then he'd reached for his prescription pad and written out the order for the first bunch of useless pills, while a tiny clump of alien cells in Carolyn's head continued to send out its microbursts of destruction. And maybe Dr. Jamal had been right. Maybe it was too late even then. But maybe Jamal was full of shit. Maybe Jamal was just a stranger in a strange land, trying to get along, trying not to make waves. Maybe this and maybe that. Ralph didn't know for sure and never would. All he really knew was that Litchfield hadn't been around when the final two tasks of their marriage had been set before them. Her job to die, his job to watch her do it. Is that what I want to do? Go to Litchfield and watch him reach for his prescription pad again? Maybe this time it would work, he argued to, with himself. At the same time, his hand stole out, seemingly of its own volition, and took a box of Sleepinex from the shelf. He turned it over, held it slightly away from his eyes, so he could read the small print on the side panel, and ran his eyes slowly down the list of active ingredients. He had no idea of how to pronounce most of the jaw-breaking words, and even less of what they were, or how they were supposed to help you sleep. Yes, he answered the voice. Maybe this time it would work. But maybe the real answer would be just to find another doc. Help you? A voice asked from directly behind Ralph's shoulder. He was in the act of returning the box of Sleepinex to its place, meaning to take something that sounded a little less like a sinister drug in a Robin Cook novel, when the voice spoke. Ralph jumped and knocked a dozen assorted boxes of synthetic sleep onto the floor. Oh, sorry, clumsy, Ralph said and looked over his shoulder. Not at all. My fault entirely. And before Ralph could do more than pick up two boxes of Sleepinex and one box of drowsy gel capsules, the man in the white smock who had spoken to him
had swept up the rest and was redistributing them with the speed of a riverboat gambler dealing a hand of poker. According to the gold ID bar pinned to his breast, this was Joe Weiser, Rite Aid pharmacist. "Now," Weiser said, dusting off his hands and turning to Ralph with a friendly grin, "let's start over. Can I help you? You look a little lost." Ralph's initial response, annoyance at being disturbed while having a deep and meaningful conversation with himself, was being replaced with guarded interest. "Well, I don't know," he said, and gestured to the array of sleeping potions. "Do any of these actually work?" Weiser's grin widened. He was a tall, middle-aged man with fair skin and thinning brown hair, which he parted in the middle. He stuck out his hand, and Ralph had barely begun the polite reciprocatory gesture when his own hand was swallowed. "I'm Joe," the pharmacist said, and tapped the gold tunic pin with his free hand. "I used to be Joe Wise, but now I'm older and wiser." This was almost certainly an ancient joke, but it had lost none of its savor for Joe Wiser, who laughed uproariously. Ralph smiled a polite little smile with just the smallest touch of anxiety around its edges. The hand which had enfolded his was clearly a strong one, and he was afraid if the pharmacist squeezed hard, his hand might finish the day in a cast. He found himself wishing, at least momentarily, that he'd taken his problem to Paul Durden downtown after all. Then Weiser gave his hand two energetic pumps and let go. "I'm Ralph Roberts. Nice to meet you, Mr. Weiser."
"Mutual."
"Now, concerning the efficacy of these fine products, let me answer your question with one of my own. To wit, does a bear shit in a telephone booth?" Ralph burst out laughing. "Rarely, I'd think," he said, when he could say anything again. "Correct," Weiser glanced at the sleeping aides, a wall done in shades of blue. "Thank God I'm a pharmacist and not a salesman, Mr. Roberts. I'd starve trying to peddle stuff door to door. Are you an insomniac? I'm asking partly because you're investigating the sleeping aids, but mostly because you have that lean and hollow-eyed look." Ralph said, "Mr. Weiser, I'd be the happiest man on earth if I could get 5 hours sleep some night. And I'd settle for 4. How long's it been going on, Mr. Roberts? Or do you prefer Ralph?" "Ralph's fine." "Good. And I'm Joe." "It started in April, I think. A month or 6 weeks after my wife died, anyway." "Gee, I'm sorry to hear you lost your wife. My sympathies." "Thank you," Ralph said, then repeated the old formula. "I miss her a lot, but I was glad when our suffering was over. Except now you're suffering. For, let's see," Weiser counted quickly on his big fingers, "going on half a year now." Ralph suddenly found himself fascinated by those fingers. No jet contrails this time, but the tip of each one appeared to be wrapped in a bright silvery haze. Like tinfoil, you could somehow look right through. He suddenly found himself thinking of Carolyn again, and remembering the phantom smells she had sometimes complained of last fall. Cloves, sewage, burning ham. Maybe this was the male equivalent, and the onset of his own brain tumor had been signaled not by headaches, but by insomnia. "Self-diagnosis is a fool's game, Ralph, so why don't you just quit it?" He moved his eyes resolutely back to Wise's big, pleasant face. No silvery haze there. Not so much as a hint of haze. He was almost sure of it. "That's right," he said. "Going on half a year." "It seems longer. A lot longer, actually." "Any noticeable pattern?" "There usually is. I mean, do you toss and turn before you go to sleep, or..." "I'm a premature waker." Wise's eyebrows went up. "And read a book or three about the problem, too, I deduce." If Litchfield had made a remark of this sort, Ralph would have read condescension into it. From Joe Weiser, he sensed not condescension, but genuine admiration. "I read what the library had, but there wasn't much, and none of it has helped much." Ralph paused, then added, "The truth is, none of it has helped at all." "Well, let me tell you what I know on the subject, and you just kind of flop your hand when I start heading into territory you've already explored. Who's your doctor, by the way?"
"Litchfield."
"Uh-huh. And you usually trade at..."
"Where?"
The People's Drug out at the mall? The Rexall downtown? The Rexall. You're incognito today, I take it. Ralph blushed, then grinned. Yeah, something like that. Uh-huh. And I don't need to ask if you've been to see Litchfield about your problem, do I? If you had, you wouldn't be exploring the wonderful world of patent medicines. Is that what these are? Patent medicines? Put it this way, I'd feel a hell of a lot more comfortable selling most of this crap off the back of a big red wagon with fancy yellow wheels. Ralph laughed, and the bright silvery cloud which had been gathering in front of Joe Wise's tunic blew away when he did. That kind of salesmanship I might be able to get into, Wise said with a misty little grin. I'd get a sweet little honey bun to do a dance in a sequined bra and a pair of harem pants. Call her Little Egypt, like in that old Coaster song. She'd be my warm-up act. Plus, I'd have a banjo picker. In my experience, there's nothing like a good dose of banjo music to put people in a buying mood. Wiser looked off past the laxatives and analgesics, enjoying this gaudy daydream. Then he looked back at Ralph again. For a premature waker like you, Ralph, this stuff is entirely useless. You'd be better off with a shot of booze or one of those wave machines they sell through the catalogs. And looking at you, I'd guess you'd probably tried them both. Yes, along with about 24 other old-timer-tested home remedies. Ralph laughed again. He was coming to like this man very much. Try 24 and you'll be in the ballpark. Well, you're an industrious bugger. I'll give you that, Wiser said, and waved a hand at the blue boxes. These things are nothing but antihistamines. Essentially, they're trading on a side effect. Antihistamines make people sleepy. Check out a box of Comtrex or Benadryl down there in decongestants, and it'll say you shouldn't take it if you're going to be driving or operating heavy machinery. For people who suffer from occasional sleeplessness, a Somanex every now and then may work. It gives them a nudge. But they wouldn't work for you in any case, because your problem isn't getting to sleep. It's staying asleep. Correct? Correct. Can I ask you a delicate question? Sure, I guess so. Do you have a problem with Dr. Litchfield regarding this? Maybe have some doubts about his ability to understand how really pissy your insomnia is making you feel? Yes, Ralph said gratefully. Do you think I should go see him, try to explain that to him so he'll understand? To this question, Wiser would, of course, respond in the affirmative, and Ralph would finally make the call. And it would be, should be, Litchfield. He saw that now. It was madness to think of hooking up with a new doctor at his age. Can you tell Dr. Litchfield you're seeing things? Can you tell him about the blue marks you saw shooting up from the tips of Lois Chass's fingers? The footprints on the sidewalk, like the footprints in an Arthur Murray dance diagram? The silvery stuff around the tips of Joe Wise's fingers? Are you really going to tell Litchfield that stuff? And if you're not, if you can't, why are you going to see him in the first place, no matter what this guy recommends? Wiser, however, surprised him by going in an entirely different direction. Are you still dreaming? Yes, quite a lot, in fact, considering that I'm down to about 3 hours sleep a night. Are they coherent dreams? Dreams that consist of perceivable events and have some kind of narrative flow, no matter how kooky, or are they just jumbled images? Ralph remembered a dream he'd had the night before. He and Helen Deepnow and Bill McGovern had been having a three-sided game of frisbee in the middle of Harris Avenue. Helen had a pair of huge, clunky saddle shoes on her feet. McGovern was wearing a sweatshirt with a vodka bottle on it. Absolutely the best, the sweatshirt proclaimed. The frisbee had been bright red with fluorescent green stripes. Then Rosalie the dog had shown up. The faded blue bandana someone had hung around her neck was flapping as she limped toward them. All at once she had leaped into the air, snatched the frisbee, and gone running off with it in her mouth. Ralph wanted to give chase, but McGovern said, "Relax, Ralph, we're getting a whole case of them for Christmas." Ralph turned to him, intending to point out that Christmas was over 3 months away, and to ask what the hell they were going to do if they wanted to play frisbee between then and now. But before he could, the dream had either ended or gone on to some other, less vivid mind movie. If I understand what you're saying, Ralph replied, my dreams are coherent.
Good.
I also want to know if they're lucid dreams. Lucid dreams fulfill two requirements. First, you know you're dreaming. Second, you can often influence the course the dream takes. You're more than just a passive observer.
Ralph nodded.
Sure, I have those too. In fact, I seem to have a lot of them lately. I was just thinking of one I had last night. In it, this stray dog I see on the street from time to time ran off with a frisbee some friends of mine and I were playing with. I was mad that she broke up the game, and I tried to make her drop the frisbee just by sending her the thought. Sort of a telepathic command, you know? He uttered a small, embarrassed chuckle, but Wiser only nodded matter-of-factly. Did it work?
Not this time, Ralph said. But I think I have made that sort of thing work in other dreams.
Only I can't be sure, because most of the dreams I have seem to fade away almost as soon as I wake up.
That's the case with everyone, Wiser said. The brain treats dreams as disposable matter, storing them in extreme short-term memory.
You know a lot about this, don't you?
Insomnia interests me very much. I did 2 research papers on the link between dreams and sleep disorders when I was in college.
Wiser glanced at his watch. It's my break time. Would you like to have a cup of coffee and a piece of apple pie with me? There's a place just 2 doors down, and the pie is fantastic.
Sounds good, but maybe I'll settle for an orange soda. I've been trying to cut down on my coffee intake.
Understandable, but completely useless, Wiser said cheerfully. Caffeine is not your problem, Ralph.
No, I suppose not.
But what is? To this point, Ralph had been quite successful at keeping the misery out of his voice. But now it crept back in.
Wiser clapped him on the shoulder and looked at him kindly.
That, he said, is what we're going to talk about. Come on.